What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
I got stuff for you.
Holy moly.
I need to get some snakes and release them around my house.
But they love eating people. They love eating kids.
These guys are the scientists of the supernatural, lecturers leaving lessons for inquiring laymen. They are applying the scientific method to a world that baffles science. They are the cryptids of the corn.
Every day that you open your mouth,
I know, right?
I'm more convinced that you're abducted by aliens.
No.
And it just stood up. I mean, it just like kept going and going. And she goes, what the?
These are idiots.
I was laughing reading this because I already knew how you would feel.
Idiot. What part of the story fits your balloon?
Well,
this isn't a UFO. Yeah.
But who else has big black wings and red eyes?
Batman.
Well, Mothman.
Oh, yeah, Mothman.
Well, everyone, I think we know exactly what it is. So say it all with me. It was the Sandhill Crane.
Would you try it?
No.
You wouldn't eat it?
No.
Why?
Because they're probably toxic.
There'd be a lot of poop in my pants. Seeing a 6-foot alligator go swinging through the air and slam into a tree.
Welcome back to Cryptids of the Corn Podcast. I'm the great and powerful Mr. E.
And I'm J Clone 779.
Ooh.
Season finale clone.
It's season finale. Season 7 finale.
We're finally, you know, I've been counting the days on my calendar waiting for this time, and it's here now.
10 extra episodes.
It came out like a month after I marked it on my calendar.
A little over a month after. It just aligned in a poor time, so we added 10 extra episodes.
Bonus.
Bonus. But yeah. So if anybody, if you're new, the season finales, we always try to do, they're always pretty hefty. And I try to figure out something different every time, as in a different style, different flavor.
Right. Different creatures.
Yeah.
Land, sea, and air.
So this is a mix of two different things.
Okay.
The people at home already know what it is, and you don't.
Why do they know?
Because they read the titles.
Oh, yeah. I forgot how that works.
So the only hint I gave you is it was the once was's.
Oh, yeah, you did. You did. Oh, I think I kind of got an idea now.
Oh, go ahead. Guess.
Does it have to do with, like, extinct animals?
No.
Oh, once was-es. Once was-es. I guess I'm
While you ponder on it, I do want to address something to everybody. It's been crazy, you know, for everybody at home and real life and all this stuff happening. A friend of the podcast has unfortunately passed away. Dr. Jeff Meldrum, very sweet man, a titan in the field of cryptozoology, of Sasquatch. I feel it'll be a long time before there's anybody that's even close to his credentials taking the subject seriously.
I agree with that.
And, well, I didn't agree with everything he thought on Sasquatch. He was an amazing man. He stuck his neck out there for the Sasquatch community. And he will be deeply missed. Mm-hmm. And our deepest condolences to his wife and his family. And I'm only saying this because they've already posted about it. So if you see me post on the Facebook page, that's what I said, is I didn't want to post about it until the family had posted it, and they had posted. Right. He did pass away from brain cancer. He lost his battle with that. We knew he'd been having some health troubles. I didn't know it was that severe.
Right, yeah. Yeah, but like you said, he's an important figure to the community. And, you know, for a college professor to give credence or to just to even take the subject seriously.
Exactly.
Is important. And we need more professors like that because, you know, we see how easily they can get locked into a box of academia and these things aren't possible. But he was one that proved or just showed that his curiosity to learn and explore new ideas, even though at first he did not believe. Mm-hmm. He didn't believe in Bigfoot.
He went out to disprove it.
And sure enough, you follow the evidence because that's how science works.
Mm-hmm. And he was a great scientist. And he was an amazing man.
Very, very kind.
Every time we ran into him speaking at events and, you know, vending and all this stuff.
Yep.
He's been great and he's been very humbling to be around.
He even taught me how to properly do a foot cast.
That's why you were teaching a class.
Yes, I was teaching a class of foot casting, even though I'd never done a foot cast in my life before.
Yes, you had.
Not where I'm like leading the.
No.
The only time I'd done a foot cast was I was in a class and B Mills showed me what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd never done one, you know what I mean? Like from scratch. Here, I'm mixing up all the material. That's putting it all together.
That's the picture I used too.
I seen that, yeah. And sure enough, I'm teaching this class to all these people that paid money, the way I got into it, it was me and Jake Dressel, because you weren't there. You were, Emily
in the
was
hospital.
In the hospital, yep, yeah, with the twins. And so I'm teaching this class, and right before it starts, who shows up is Dr. Jeff Meldrum, sits right in the front row, and I'm like, oh, crap, the expert on foot casting, and here I am about to teach him. But he was nice, and there were some things that I would... didn't quite fully share with everyone. He would jump right in and
very kind
and,
about
and help me out. And yeah, awesome, awesome dude. I learned, actually, I'll tell you the one thing he taught me that day. And when foot casting, it's important, hairspray is an important tool to have. And why that is you spray the whatever impression you find on the ground, you spray it with hairspray first, because what that does is it'll lock kind of the dirt
into place.
Yeah, everything into place. So when you pour the cast, you're not disturbing it by physically pouring in.
That's
not distorting it.
That's how you get those really fine details.
Yes. It preserves all the fine details.
Thermal ridges and all that.
Mm-hmm.
Fingernails.
And the hairspray helps release it, too, from the cast after it's done. So it's kind of dual purpose. But Jeff's the one that taught me that. So now I'm sharing it with all of you.
All right. So the once was. This whole season finale is about creatures that were once cryptids.
Like Fuzzy Wuzzy?
Fuzzy Wuzzy was a bear.
Once was.
So the once was, these were once cryptids and now are actually documented creatures. So we're going to mix it in with kind of a game show too.
Okay.
Where I'm going to give you a lot of, so some of them I could find a lot of folklore, some of them I couldn't, so I had to like write my own stuff.
Yeah.
I'm going to describe the creatures as the folklore aspect.
Okay.
Where you're getting it as you're the first Western scientist in the area.
Oh, let me put my Western scientist hat.
Natives are dumb.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
That, I mean, that's what, you know.
It's what they think, yeah. No, they don't know nothing. Oh, gosh. Now you just put my thought in my head. Here we go.
Don't do that.
Yeah.
But no, but because I'm going to give you, like, the folklore side of it, where they're talking about creatures in these areas and what they say about them. And then I want to see if you can guess the actual creature. I'm going to say you probably know about, that I know you know of about half the creatures on this big list.
Okay. So I should be able to get some of it just from doing the show.
Yeah.
But some are new to me?
Yes, 100%.
Oh, great.
So this first one.
Well, before I start, yes. Are any of them Fuzzy Wuzzy?
Some of them are fuzzy.
You know, he was a bear.
I won't give you any more hints.
Okay.
Lobos de Rio.
Okay.
Lobos de Rio.
I know what Lobos means.
What is?
Wolf.
Ah, oh, dang it. Yeah. The wolf of the river.
Okay.
De Rio, the river.
That I didn't know.
Yeah, the wolf of the river.
Okay.
These creatures are known as the wolves of the river.
Ah.
They are said to be as large, if not larger, than a man. Specifically, they're calling the Amazonian River Basin home. They are famous for targeting and hunting and harassing other large apex predators. They are known for being highly intelligent and being very secretive. They are famous for mocking human voices, trying to lure you to the water's edge like a siren.
Oh, okay.
Where they will, like, hey, hey,
yeah,
hey. So they lure people down to the river. They are said to be extremely dangerous when provoked. What they kind of look like is like a snub-nosed big wolf and a snake had a baby.
Okay.
These big, heavy-set jaws and heads. And that's what all the natives would warn people about, is that if you get bit by this thing, it's going to suck. They can deliver an absolutely devastating bite. They are known to hunt anacondas, caiman, jaguars, and even other Amazonian cryptids.
Okay. Oh, okay.
So they would talk about stuff, even not quite the Mapungari size stuff.
Yeah.
But some of the big, you know, river cryptids, they'd be like, yeah, they get out of the water when the Lobos de Rio come around.
So this thing, it has legs and tail, yeah, and all. Okay.
Yeah. So kind of, they are furry, big, heavy. It's kind of, imagine a wolf, a bulldog, and a crocodile had a baby.
Okay.
It's kind of the rough description of these things. But they're extremely large. They have killed people. They still are killing people.
To this day?
Yes. They are not anything to mess around with. Once again, all these were cryptids and then were proven to be real.
Oh, okay.
Do you want me to keep going some more about them?
Sure, yeah.
So they're known specifically to target jaguars because jaguars will try to prey upon their cubs.
Oh, wow. Okay, that's gutsy.
Well, it's just a jaguar thing. They're trying to eat a baby.
Yeah.
But they'll go out of their way,
like a dingo,
and run jaguars out of their whole big territory.
Oh, wow. Okay.
They've been seen biting and dragging jaguars into the water. Caiman, they'll eat the back of caiman's heads. Like a jaguar, you've seen them.
Yeah, jump out of the tree right on them.
It's one of the few animals that can make an anaconda get out of the water.
Oh, wow, okay. Yeah, that's saying something.
Any guesses?
My first guess is going to be a water panther.
So, yeah, that's probably true.
So whatever.
So why
that
they're
is.
Called... Lobos de Rio,
yeah,
wolves of the river, is they hunt in large packs.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Multi-generational packs. They'll surround prey like a wolf, and they're not afraid to chase prey onto land or threats.
Hmm.
So there'll be a jaguar, and they'll bum rush it, and they'll actually have members waiting for the jaguar to run away from the water to stop the jaguar.
Oh, wow.
They really want to kill things.
Like waiting on the shore?
Yeah.
Okay.
So they'll flank things. They're highly intelligent, and they talk all the time.
Huh.
Most of the time, it's like a chattering kind of talk. But they can mimic human voices like a beluga whale can.
Okay.
Where it's like you can tell it's something mimicking a person.
Yeah.
Like, you ever heard the seal or beluga whale say, like, hey, yeah. It's almost like
so.
A little kid, like, mimicking.
Yeah.
Where you can tell that's just something repeating what it's heard.
Right, yeah. Hmm. I don't know. Is it some kind of hyena?
South America.
Yeah, South American water hyena.
No guesses for real?
I mean, the water panther was the... Whatever that is. I mean, I'm doing the cryptic with the cryptid.
Yes, what do we think the water panther is?
Oh, specifically?
Yeah, do you remember?
No, I don't. I don't remember.
The first addition to our list is the Amazonian giant river otter.
Oh, the river otter. Oh,
the
wow.
biggest otter in the world. And everything I've told you about it is true.
Oh, wow.
So when, you know, so this is also the game show aspect and the mix of, there's going to be like a heavy Freaky Fauna Friday aspect.
I can tell already. We need like do we have a button for like when I get it right or get it wrong?
Yeah, I can. So what was your guess again?
Water panther. It was kind of a cop out.
Yeah. And then... I do have some of you get it right.
Gosh,
I have two of you get it wrong and two of you get it right.
So long and embarrassing.
What?
The dunce horn.
Oh. But yeah, so you're a European settler or explorer.
Yes.
You come in and they're warning you. You've seen some of the other stuff and hint, this is not the only Amazonian one from this time on this list.
Okay.
So in Europe, you have otters. They're tiny compared to these things.
Right.
Some of these guys are just absolutely massive. So they're warning you. About, yeah, they'll surround your boat and they'll hop in your boat and they'll bite the absolute life out of you. They're huge. You've seen, you know, caiman and anacondas, and they're not even scared. The natives aren't even scared. They're warning you about these guys. What do you think?
Sounds like some tall tales if you ask me, and they probably just want to keep me out of this river. I bet there's a bunch of gold back there.
There is a bunch of gold.
Gold and money. Huh.
So yeah, we're going to talk about the Amazonian giant river otter. They are endangered, but they're pretty much anywhere through Central South America.
Mm, how big are they?
Big.
I want to look up a picture of them.
The giant river otter, or the giant otter, also is the South American carnivore, is the longest member of the weasel family, the muscalids.
Oh, cool. Okay.
They globally successful group of predators. These guys can reach 6 foot long.
What?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's pretty big.
And there's some examples of them actually getting a little bigger than that.
That's wild. Because I've been around otters before, and I mean, they got very pretty powerful jaws. I mean, teeth, sharp teeth.
Even American river otters are nothing compared. And we had one kill a lady in Chicago a couple years ago.
Yeah, the one I seen, you know, it was just a lake otter up in Minnesota, and, you know, 2 foot at max.
Yeah, I mean, ours get 4 foot.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the same species. They get, like, 4 foot, but they're, you know, a lot of that's tail.
I'm just imagining, I guess 2 foot, just the body is what I'm thinking, like, the mass.
So probably 4 foot.
Maybe.
Well, their tail's almost the same length as their body.
Yeah, I guess you just don't really take that into account when you're watching them, but, no, I didn't want to be in the, and that one wasn't even that, she was pretty standoffish from us.
Mm-hmm.
But I was close enough, the closest I've ever been to an otter, but I did not for a second want to be in the water in the lake swimming around that thing.
Muscalids are one of the scariest things on this planet.
Like little weasels and ferrets? Mm-hmm.
If weasels got 40 pounds, they could kill an elephant.
Probably. A 6 footer? No, thank you.
So atypical for muscalids, the giant river otter is extremely social, even when compared to other river otter species.
Okay.
The family group typically is supported by 3 to 8 members, but like up to 30 has been documented, where 2 or 3 families will kind of hang out together, especially if a large carnivore enters kind of their domain.
So they kind of band together.
Yeah.
Today, strength in numbers. Remember that, humanity.
The groups are centered around a dominant breeding pair. These are extremely comprehensive and cooperative. Although they are considered generally peaceful as a species, the species is extremely territorial. And aggression has been observed between groups and with humans.
Hmm.
Especially if you accidentally get too close to their dens. They can go from being pretty playful to like ripping your throat out.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Have you ever seen them eat fish?
Like, oh, yeah.
Just crunch through the bones like it's nothing.
Like I said, that one up in Minnesota, she had 3 babies with her. Or, you know, babies, toddlers, whatever. So we would feed them, you know, our big fish, our catch or whatever, or carcasses, and she would go out and grab them and she'd swim back to their babies. But the one time I was kind of hanging out to where I knew she was bringing them back, so just watching them, so I waited there before she even went there. So she brought them over there but didn't see me there, so I was kind of hiding just listening, and they were crunching. Even the babies could crunch through the bones like just nothing.
And they have these giant, they literally like bulldogs, where they just have these, or pit bulls,
like strong jaws,
and these big crushing teeth.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely not a slashing bite.
It's
a crushing bite.
Crunch and pull.
Because they eat clams and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah. They're
not sea otters.
Big difference.
The zoo, the guy made me so mad. They hold hands and they float and they crack oysters on their belly. Yeah. That's sea otters. Those are American river otters. They're different.
Different behaviors. Different species.
Mm-hmm. They're also, these giant otters are diurnal, which means
they only come out during the day.
Mostly active during the day.
Right. Like us.
Another cool fact about giant otters or giant river otters is that they are the noisiest of any muscalid species.
Well, that's good to know. You know they're coming.
Oh, it's the confidence level. They do not care who or what hears them because they're not scared of anything.
That's fine. Yeah, fair enough.
Their distinct vocalizations have been documented for indicating alarms, aggressions, reassurance, and many, many other things. The giant otter ranges across northern central South America. It lives mostly along the Amazon River and the Pantanal. Its distribution has been greatly reduced, though, and is now discontinuous.
Okay.
So that means it's fragmented populations.
Yes.
Decades of poaching for their velvety pelt peaked in the 1950s and 60s, considerably diminished their population numbers. The species was listed as endangered in 1999. And wild populations were estimated to be typically below 5,000 individuals.
They're dwindling.
Mm-hmm. It is one of the most endangered mammal species in the Neotropics. habitat degradation, loss, great current threats. They are also rare in captivity. They do not do well in captivity compared to other otter species that do.
Yeah. Is it just because they're too big?
They're big. They have extremely big territories.
Yeah, their range.
And they like to fight.
Oh, fair enough.
Like, not even, I'm talking like, they pick fights with jaguars. Just they pick fights with caimans and anacondas.
They're like a honey badger.
Mm-hmm. In 2003, there was only about 60 otters being held in the world in captivity.
Huh. Of these guys?
Of giant river otters.
Okay.
If you've seen a river otter in captivity, it was probably an American river otter, which are considerably smaller and easier to keep.
Mm-hmm.
Our small-clawed Asian otter, which are the ones that most zoos have, because they breed really quick and they do comparatively extremely well in captivity.
Yeah.
Those are the ones here in Ohio. That's the only otter you can own privately.
Gotcha.
Because they're tiny. I mean, relatively speaking, you know, they're like a pound.
Right, yeah. So no big deal.
I mean, this thing could kill you.
Yeah, the six-footer?
Yeah, they will.
Yeah, for sure.
The otter shows a variety of adaptations suitable for its amphibious lifestyle. They have exceptionally dense fur, a wing-like tail. So it's not quite as big and flat as like a beaver tail.
Yeah.
But they actually use it to swim and pulse with.
Mm.
They have extremely webbed feet. The species prefers freshwater streams and rivers, which are usually, you know, used to seasonal flooding. They may also take freshwater lakes and springs on occasion. In contrast, exclusively campsiting close to their feeding area, clearing large amounts of vegetation. So you see this on the bank, is what they're saying. This big, and the legends talked about it. Oh, it's not hard to figure out where they're eating and hanging out because they clear off a bunch of vegetation.
Uh-huh.
So if you see these big clearings, don't go there.
That's where the giant river otter.
Yeah.
It's his domain.
Anything, they pretty much eat everything. The big part of their diet is fish, though, particularly catfish.
Oh.
But they eat crabs, turtles, snakes, and caiman.
Okay.
There has been no serious natural predation for them other than humans.
That makes sense.
So jaguars typically avoid them. Caiman avoid them. Pretty much all of that. Although they do compete with other predators, such as neotropical otters and various other caiman species for food sources. So there are a couple other smaller species of otter that they compete with.
Okay.
And crocodilians like caiman they compete with. They're eating the same things.
Gotcha.
Any questions?
No.
So that was your first one. I mean, I have more about them if you want, but other than that, their skulls are extremely, extremely dense.
Okay, so just to recap, I guess, with the otter and that whole season finale itself. So when you refer to these guys as it once was, is...
They were cryptids. So okay. when European settlers or explorers first got to South America, they were writing about this indigenous folklore about these things. And the otters, they didn't see otters for a long time.
Gotcha, okay. Because
they were very scared of the boats. These new type of ships that were coming into the Amazon, and they were very secretive and stuff like that. So they talked about them as a river. They're like, there's apparently wolves that live in the river.
Yeah.
And they would, when they were taking them back to, not taking them back to England, when they were taking the stories back to England and Europe, there was just this whole thing where there, apparently there's giant wolves that live in these rivers.
Yeah. I wonder if it was just their, you know, their aggressiveness or wolf-like behavior.
It was that.
Yeah.
It was that, you know, lost in translation, kind of not.
Right, yeah.
And you'll see that that's kind of a common theme with a lot of these, is that when you're first dissecting a language, some people may be taking certain words too seriously.
Right.
Or
right.
Not in the vein that the native speaker wants it to be taken.
Makes sense, yeah.
When you're talking about, like, Spanish and stuff like that, you know, Spanish has, I mean, I don't know to speak Spanish. I took it for forever, and I still don't know anything about the language. But, like, it has genders on words.
Right.
And everything. So that doesn't translate well to a language that doesn't have any of those. Because why is this computer a boy?
Right, yeah, exactly.
That doesn't make any sense to me.
No.
But it does to their, you know.
To their language, yes. Yeah. Some things are masculine and feminine. I learned it in French class, too. Took 4 years of it, and I don't know a thing.
But, yeah, and they're known, like I said, they will mimic human voices. It's one of the coolest things about them. So this, like, and they kind of do it in, like, a sing-songy fashion.
Hmm.
And it's really creepy.
Like a show tunes kind of way?
No.
Like, hello, my baby.
Like
hello,
a monster is coming for you.
Oh, okay.
Like, hey, yeah. But it's pitch black on a river.
They're singing.
Hey, yeah.
Hey, yeah, by Outkast.
Hey, yeah. Help, help,
oh,
help.
You think you got it. Oh, you got that fish. But now I'm going to get you and I'm going to eat your face off.
You want to guess what their favorite prey is?
Their favorite prey. Let's say it's probably a turtle.
Piranhas.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they love eating piranhas.
Wow. Pacus, maybe? Probably. They're down there, right? In South America? Pacus?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's a big meal for a,
they are a 6-foot
river otter.
But yeah. But yeah, Colombia, like Colombian natives talked about them. They rarely killed them. They only ever even went out of their way to kill them if they were like actively breaking into their nets and fish traps.
Right, just being menaces.
But yeah, they were told even, so the natives very much understood that they were very important to coexist with, where they were very, very crucial to the environment.
Okay.
So when they were talking about the river wolves being these big aggressive things, and they're like, well, why don't you just, because in Europe, what do they do with all their wolves?
They kill everything. They kill everything.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a reason there's nothing left.
Right. I mean, look at all the bugs. The bugs, they're gone.
But yeah.
What are we supposed to eat in the future?
So the Bororo people.
Okay.
It's obviously not English. And then somebody tried to put it in English. Associated the giant otters with fish and with fire.
Okay.
Saying that they were basically like the North American water panther, guardians of the underworld, or the worlds in between worlds.
Interesting.
Where there's apparently portals, and these guys would guard them in the rivers.
Hmm.
So they have supernatural aspects to them as well.
Yeah, there's something, definitely something there. Wonder what that is. Well, I mean, like, with natives in general... whether it's Native American, South, you know, like the totem poles, for example, mm-hmm. It's like those animals definitely represent more than just the animal.
Sure.
Like how, so I wonder if it's kind of that same kind of deal or that same vein.
I think, especially you'll see with Amazon, there's a lot of monsters that come out of the water.
Yeah.
So even without being, excuse me, that you would think there's a portal that these things are coming out of.
Like, literally?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, there's just... And these are the ones that guard the hole that go creatures going in and out of. But also, I mean, look at the weirdest places in North America. Point Pleasant, where there was used to be the Water Panther mural.
Yeah.
On the giant rock face that doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, it's true, yeah.
Where it's this turning energy point.
Hmm.
So there could be something... it's not figurative. It's actual.
Right, yeah. I wonder... Yeah, I mean... I don't know. That's definitely getting into a weird, deep worm rabbit hole. But
I mean, that's the season finale. If you want to talk about it, talk about it.
Yeah, if like...
I only have 24 of these things to go
okay,
through.
So we got plenty of
some
time.
Some of them are really quick.
Fast, yeah.
Because some of them I don't have a lot on because the animal is only seen, for example, I won't tell you which animal, but the animal is only seen 4 times.
Yeah. Well, you know how like...
Actually, that's not even the rarest.
Well, that's exciting then.
2 times.
I'm looking forward
to it. One
of
these animals was seen 2 times and you know what it is because I've talked about it.
Oh, that's foreshadowing. But like, you know, I guess for example, this summer in the garden, certain plants attract certain bugs, you know mm-hmm. what I mean? So if, what if there is certain areas or certain points of energy where like two rivers combining, where this big, powerful creature is more of a, I'm not just saying like it's drawn to that area for that specific reason, but I don't know, maybe it's just the physical representation that manifests itself into those areas to. Yeah, I don't know. It's weird. The world's weird. We don't know how it works.
Another weird little thing is Mexicali Creation Stories, which is an indigenous group.
Okay.
Suggest, and there used to be otter fishing practices in the past.
Okay.
Where they, you know, ever seen the tribes that fish with dolphins?
They fish with them?
Like the dolphins run the fish in, yeah. The people with nets, and they share.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so there's a bunch of places in the world. That's happened 4 different times in the world.
That's pretty cool.
Where people and dolphins have figured it out.
Yeah.
There's some suggestions that these wolves were doing that with people a long time ago.
Or wolves or the river otter?
The river otter.
Okay. Huh. I mean, if they're that social, I mean, being smart enough, food's food. If you can figure out a way to get food from, especially working with humans, I mean, if it's easier, you're going to do it if you figure it out.
So, this next one, we're going to hop into a whole different area in the world.
All right.
New Guinea.
Ooh. Let me pack up my my white man European traveling suitcase.
Khakis and
my safari hat. Yeah.
And a big shotgun.
in a oversized net.
In a big butterfly net.
Yes, giant.
Oh, we're going ghost hunting on this one.
Make sure I get the fine mesh on this net.
The fine mesh.
Yeah, that'll even catch a ghost.
Ectoplasm.
That'd be a good, that's a good way to sell. That's marketing.
So this is one that I could not find a lot of the lore on, besides the real basic stuff, a couple paragraphs here and there that were just repeated on the internet a bunch of times. But the New Guinea singing ghost.
The New Guinea what ghost?
Singing.
Singing, okay.
Singing. The locals often speak of beings of ghostly figures that live in the shadows and the mist of the forest and the mountains.
Mm.
Moving like shadows among the trees. They are seldom seen, but they are always heard. Their songs are said to hold deep meaning. Everything from predicting the weather are serving as omens for those who understand their melodies.
Okay.
To the indigenous people of Papua New Guinea, these creatures were much a part of the landscape as the mountains themselves, embodying the spirits in the mysteries of the highlands of New Guinea. So in the mountains, you would hear, and you'd still hear them to this day. They're very rare, but you still hear this sing-songy, and they sound like, even to the indigenous people, a people singing.
Okay.
But they're very odd. They're very scary.
Yes.
If you didn't know what they were, like you were out there, you're a white guy in 1760, walking with all these Papua New Guinea people, and you hear these singing, they sound human and indecipherable language.
Okay.
But they're said to predict everything from the weather to omens. There are whole people dedicated in the tribe to deciphering the ghost songs.
Hmm. Interesting.
And whatever is making these songs, it moves like a shadow. They're so secretive, they do not want to be seen.
So they've never, have they seen actually seen it, or just like?
Yes.
Corners of their eyes type of stuff.
What is the topic of the season finale?
Oh, once was is, so it is a real thing.
Yes.
Because in my head, first thing I thought of was like.
This is when it was a cryptid.
Okay, fair enough. Well, the first thing I thought of, remember the, I think it's a, Colossus of Memnon or something. This is statues in Egypt. There's two of them.
Mm-hmm.
It's like too big, but they called them singing statues because supposedly when the wind would blow through them, like they would sing or hum. Yeah, or
sure.
That's what they were supposed to, or allegedly did.
Fishing poles do that.
Yeah, exactly. The fishing poles and the eyelets in a fishing pole. Same exact thing. That's kind of what I thought of. Maybe it's just the makeup of the woods and the forest. Maybe there's something out there that's just...
That is a good guess. I mean, that's a really good guess. No, but there's an animal to this.
Okay, so something, man, moves like a shadow. It's making noises. Freaky fauna. We're in New Guinea. All right, let's break this down.
What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage 1. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
This is for all the people that say we don't ever talk about cryptids, and they don't, like, yes, we do. These are all cryptids. You just don't understand what the word cryptid means.
Yeah. Well, but it's not Bigfoot, and it's not...
Dogman.
Dogman. They're not... Where's the portals?
Dogman's not even a cryptid.
Well, kind of is, yeah.
By the true definition, it's not.
Really?
But we've talked about this. We've had this argument.
I
know we did,
but, like, I still...
I don't think it's flesh and blood. If it's not flesh and blood, it's not a cryptid. It's a paranormal entity.
Well, why? What about, that's just entities we don't understand yet. That's cryptid
what is,
still, man.
What is the New Guinea singing ghost? I almost said it.
Starts with the N?
No, not just that. I almost...
Okay, I don't know. I really don't know on this one. Singing ghost? Just a secret of... Oh, it's a bird. Okay, hold on. It's definitely a bird. It's got to be, I don't know, some kind of something related to an ostrich. Yeah.
What ostrich relatives lives in New Guinea?
Emus, rays. I don't know.
The scary one.
Oh, cassowaries.
You think it's a cassowary? Is that your guess?
Yeah. It's a cassowary. You set me up. Yeah. I know. I know cassowaries don't sound like that. They're pretty.
They
They're not very, very secretive.
Distinctive. They, cassowaries do not care to hide.
Yeah, they'll go as gut. Yeah, if you just if they think you're thinking about them.
All right, you're not even in the right genre of animal.
Oh dang it! All right, it's a marmot, some sort.
That's technically closer.
Okay,
but not close. That's closer.
Now we're narrowing.
The Papua New Guinea singing dogs.
Singing dogs. Okay.
Did you know there was Papua New Guinea singing dogs?
No.
Very rare.
Well, apparently, how many albums they have?
So the New Guinea Highland dogs, or the New Guinea singing dogs, are a lineage of dog found in the New Guinea Highlands on the island of New Guinea. Once considered to be a separate species in its own right under the Canis Hellstrom, it is now considered to be closely related to the Australian dingo.
Mm.
But the dog is relatively unusual among canids.
Because it sings.
And it's one of the few quote-unquote dogs that is not a gray wolf.
Oh.
Like a dingo. It's
Canis lupus?
Yeah, it's its own, like these are their own thing.
Like the dingoes, or is the dingo part of that too?
The dingo is its own separate thing as well.
Yeah.
The dogs are relatively unusual among canids. One of the few is they are barkless.
Okay.
They can't bark.
Oh, I thought you just meant they don't, like a tree, they don't grow it on the outside.
But they have a yodel style. Of vocalizations that give them their name.
A yodeling sound?
They make some of the most incredible noises. Do you want me to cue one up for you?
Yeah, if you have it. If you have one ready or something, I don't know.
You ready?
Yeah.
This would be their yodel. I think this is a mutt, though.
Like he's mixed?
Yeah. Oh. I'll try to post a better sound, because I think all the ones we found in our little interlude there were all mutts.
Just hybrids, perhaps?
Yeah, because we'll talk about that.
Well, they're good-looking dogs, though. I mean,
they're pretty dogs.
Yeah, it does kind of look like a dingo-ish.
Mm-hmm. In 1989, the Australian mammalogist Tim Flanner took a photo of a black and tan dog in the Temfornal district. He noted that these dogs lived with local tribe people in the mountains, and that feral populations lived in the alpine and subalpine grasslands of the Star Mountains in the Wharton Range. The photo was published in his book, Mammals of New Guinea, in 2012. Australian wildlife researcher and adventure guide Tom Hawthorne took a photo of a thorny, thick-coated dog in the... I'm not even going to try to say it. It's too close to an American swear.
Okay.
And I know I'm going to mess up.
Yes.
But another region in Western Papua New Guinea, in Indonesia. But yeah, so they successfully started looking into these dogs. And in 2020, genetic studies found that the Papua New Guinea Highland wild dogs were genetically different.
Wow.
And the New Guinea singing dogs are therefore potentially an originator of both dingoes and these New Guinea Highland wild dogs.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So they thought it was the other way around for a long time.
Yeah.
That these were just wild feral dogs that once after they discovered them, and they did not discover them until the mid-1900s.
Okay.
They're very, very secretive. But like I said, the tribes people have dogs.
They had them, yeah.
But they have a domesticated version.
Okay.
So they thought it was the other way, that these were feral dogs that escaped domestication.
Oh, okay.
Now we know through genetic testing, it's probably the opposite, where the Papua New Guinea singing dogs were the originator of both the domestic version and dingoes. Any questions?
No. I mean, dog history. It's good to know.
I mean, they were not really discovered. I mean, they are very, very endangered.
That part's pretty cool, though, that we just recently, what'd you say, 2020, when we found the genetic?
Yeah, the genetic studies just came out in 2020.
That's very recent.
Because they switched from being listed as rare animals. Or sorry, they went from being listed as wild dogs to rare animals.
Yeah. I mean, that's just a testament to show, like, you know, we don't know everything. You know, we get that perception of the world that, you know, all the animals out there, you know, we already got them. We know them all. We're documented. We know everything on Earth. You know what everything is. We don't. There's so much stuff that's being discovered every single day. And then there's stuff that's being lost every single day. It's kind of like you're stuck in just like a little bubble, a time period of what just you're living through of discoveries and things lost to history. It's just, I don't know. It just kind of puts things into perspective sometimes.
So the first guy from the Western society to see one. So there was talk of them in 1897. A lieutenant governor of the British New Guinea, Sir William MacGregor, was in Mount Scarla, Papua New Guinea, at an elevation of 7,000 feet. He recorded that animals are very rare up here, but listed that he's seen some sort of dog specimen that they could not get close to.
Very secretive dogs.
And then in 1911, the first specimen was brought in. And it was by Charles Walter Davis. And he says this, it is not a true, or it's not truly a wild dog. In other words, there was a time when its forebears were not wild. But if we decide that the dog is merely feral of a domestic breed run wild, the dog is apt to do. However, we do account for habitats on Mount Shank or Scrat, however you say that. So he, the first guy in 1911,
gave up on it.
The first guy in 1911 that had one, it was just like, they're just feral dogs.
Yeah.
But yeah. And in 1954, collectors from the Australian Museum observed these dogs around villages situated at 8,000 feet in elevation.
Wow.
In the Southern Highlands province. But yeah, they finally got a pair of them in 1956 of singing dogs situated in the Hela province. The two dogs have been obtained from natives. The dogs were sent to Sir Edward Hailstone, who had them set up our native animal study in his center. In Sydney, Australia. And in 1957, Ellis Torgok examined the two singing dog specimens in the zoo and classified them as a distinct species.
Okay.
And that's how they got their last name, as Canis Hailstrom, is in honor of Hailstrom that brought the first breeding pair back to Australia.
Cool, a little nod. That's nice.
So yeah, for a long time after, even after they were seen, and so at the turn of the century, they were like, oh, yeah, there's dogs that live up here. And they were like, okay, no, they're just feral dogs. And it's the opposite. So these are very, very rare dogs.
Interesting. Yeah, that's pretty cool. I wonder if, too, like in the past, well, I don't know, because the natives still have them. You know what I mean?
They have the domesticated version, yes.
Correct. So I wonder if...
And you can, technically, you can buy Papua New Guinea singing dogs.
Wow.
But it's the mutts.
Yeah, of course. You don't get the OGs. And I'm sure.
I mean, if they're anything like dingoes, they will eat you.
And I'm sure they're cheap.
Yeah.
this rare like breed of dog from across the world. Yeah, $50.
I mean, I think one of your numbers or two of your numbers are right. I think there's just more. I think if you keep moving that decimal point over,
or you just keep adding those two numbers onto the end again. Yeah.
Yeah. So, any questions about Papua New Guinea singing dogs?
No, these are pretty cool. Didn't know about them.
They're very cool. I highly suggest you guys try to find some of the wild videos of them or them in zoos where they are. They do not have a dew claw, if that matters to anybody, a rear dew claw.
Oh, it's gone completely?
Yeah.
Now, let's see some wild Papua New Guinea wild dog art, seeing dog art.
They are really cool. They're known for teeth gnashing threats. So they actually like bears do.
Yeah.
For a thing. They are known for head tossing, which is where they throw their head back like a husky to make their sounds.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, so that one you heard here was called a corpulator scream, which the females emit a repetitive sequence of loud, high-pitched yelps lasting up to 3 minutes. The screams are strong and they have a strong arousal effect in domestic dogs.
Ooh, all right.
But yeah, so the vocalization you heard is like their most classic one, and they're highly different. Their closest thing that they're even is the Australian dingo, but they have their own thing.
They're their own special thing.
But like I said, there is a domestic version.
Yeah, I wonder too if it is just the domestic, and if it is just literally being captivity just changes them enough.
Yeah, yeah.
Like right away.
And then there's hybrid. They're mutts.
Right.
The ones in captivity. You can see because they don't have any of that white patterning on them in the wild or anything like that.
Okay, gotcha.
They look very distinct in the wild. And they're very, very secretive.
And it's I think it's just kind of cool too. Like you mentioned, the natives have it, but just human beings in general, our history with dogs and working with dogs, like having them be our right hand, especially in hunting.
There is a theory that the original Highland dogs were brought from somewhere else by people, and the original people that brought them, because it appears they're only about 12,000 years old.
Wow. Okay.
At least to that area.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's theories that they came with a different group of people that, do not live in Papua New Guinea anymore, that either died out
or left.
And the dogs were feral and then became their own species and then were re-domesticated again.
That's pretty cool. I wish you could.
Because dingoes are relatively new too to Australia.
Are they really?
So Australia is very weird. There's this current that's between Papua New Guinea and the mainland of Asia.
Uh-huh.
So one side you have elephants and dogs and tigers. The other side you have marsupials.
Yeah.
And these animals don't, it's 40 miles of open ocean.
And they don't cross it.
And they don't cross, which is weird. Elephants swim that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And they've never crossed. Dingoes are one of the only exceptions to that rule. So a big theory is that they were brought by people.
Mm.
And then they went feral. Because the only animals besides dingoes that you see in Australia that aren't like only found in Australia are mammals we brought.
Gotcha. Okay.
Rabbits, camels, those kind of things. Giraffes.
I love giraffes.
Well, I've showed you the videos of that giraffe preserve in the middle of Australia.
I think so.
Where that you go in the tunnel, it's like Jurassic Park, and then when he gets through the tunnel, there's a giraffe leaning in and looking at you.
Waiting for a carrot or some lettuce.
You ready for the next one?
Yeah.
This will probably be our last one for part one.
Okay.
Land crocodiles.
Oh, okay. All right. I like these guys. Where are we going? I got
to
pack up.
Not too far. We're not going too far. We're going to the islands of Rinca, Flores, Gila Munteg, and Pandar.
So that's
or
just...
Pandar.
Is that just outside Australia?
Yeah. Pretty close.
Okay.
But yeah, so when they... In the 1910s, rumors of people starting to see, you know, going to these islands and meeting the indigenous people and talking, said that there was gigantic land crocodiles that were absolutely terrifying.
Okay.
And this is just 1910.
So 100 years ago, roughly.
Yeah, I mean, it's not that long ago.
A little over, yeah, not that long ago.
So you get there, and these first lieutenants, so Lieutenant Van Strin Van Hensburg of the Dutch Colonial Administration, he's coming in to talk to these islands. I left one of the islands out because I feel like it'll give it away.
Okay.
So he comes to this chain of islands, and he notices all of the houses are built on stilts, like for flooding and stuff like that.
Okay.
And they're like, why do you have that? And they're like, land crocodiles. Like, what do you mean land crocodiles? There's 20-foot monsters that live in the jungle that at night they'll eat you.
Yeah.
So you have to build your houses up off the ground. Or they'll eat you.
Right, in your sleep.
And they're if they bite you, you die. Even if you get away, if they bite you, you die. And then, so he's like, well, what do they look like? And he's just describing these gigantic lizard, crocodilian-like creatures. They drag their tail. They can stand up on their hind legs. So land crocodiles, or even they were starting to call them, like, dragons.
Ooh.
And so some of these early Dutch settlers were like, this is one of the last bits of dragons.
All right, where's Sir George?
Like, they really were starting to think that, okay, dragons are real. We killed off all of ours in Europe, and we just finally got to somewhere that still has dragons.
Right, the last stand.
So the first documented encounter with the land crocodile of a European, and this is that Lieutenant Van, he has Van in his name twice, Hensbrook. The director of the Zoological Museum at Borjo, Java, Peter Owens, published a paper on the topic in 1912 after receiving a photo and a skin from the lieutenant. The lieutenant went right into the jungle and killed a medium-sized one.
Nice.
And he skinned it, and he brought it out, and the locals are like, why'd you kill a baby?
Right, yeah.
You know they're going to get mad.
Uh-oh.
Because this thing's like 8 foot long, the one he killed.
Oh, boy.
And they're like, that's a baby. Don't do that.
Where was the mom?
Yeah.
About to find out, huh?
Yeah. As well as two other specimens that were collected from different individuals. So pieces are starting to come back to this museum, this naturalist. The first two live land crocodiles arrived in Europe and were exhibited at the Reptile House in the London Zoo in 1927.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. So the people of these islands said that they could swim. You do not leave your trash or like we eat very high up, because they will just destroy everything. They have super, super powerful noses.
Can they not climb?
So they would literally pull their ladders up at night.
Okay.
So they're on stilts, so they can't really, they could probably climb up the stilts, but they couldn't get into anything when they got up it.
Yeah.
Any ideas before I give you more information?
Yeah, I think I might know what this one is.
Yeah, which is it?
Well, it could be the megalomania. That could be
megalania.
Or yeah, not the,
megalomania is something different.
That's a song. Yeah. No, megalania, sorry. Could be that, but I don't think it's that.
They ended up in a zoo in 1927.
Exactly. That's what threw me off. I'm like, okay, it's not that one. So that just reduces me down to what I believe is probably the Komodo dragon.
Yes, the island of Komodo is the island I left off.
I figured. You said something about Gila's island. I was going to say Gila monster right off the Gila beginning. Gila Monteg. That's pretty close.
The other venomous lizard.
Right, yeah.
So yeah, they're talking about Komodo dragons.
All right.
So literally, they weren't they weren't even, Europeans didn't even encounter them until 19, like 10 and 11.
That's just weird to me.
These islands are very remote. The people have been living them with them a long time.
Yeah.
And Komodo dragons, until people got there, we've talked about this on the podcast before, were actually on the downslope.
Hmm.
Because they'd eaten their islands out.
Oh, okay.
Where they'd eaten everything big until humans brought water buffalo and deer to the islands.
Yeah.
Because there used to be elephants on the islands that they ate all the elephants.
They ate the elephants?
Yes. Komodo dragons ate, they weren't like full, they were smaller elephants, but they were still elephants.
Yeah, it's still.
There was elephants and giant swans.
Jeez.
And they ate them all. And then people showed up.
I'm so.
So when people first got to the islands, they were very rare. But due to we'll talk about some special abilities that the Komodo dragon has that allows them to survive these things.
Gotcha.
So this probably wasn't the first time they'd eaten their islands completely empty. They can swim dozens and dozens of miles of open ocean. They can dive a little bit to eat. They've been seen eating stuff like moray eels and stuff like that.
Wow.
They do have a venomous bite.
Yes.
And it's not toxic. It's been argued for years and years and years now. They do have venom glands in their throat. It's just very far back, and they just secrete it over their teeth, plus their toxic bite.
So they bite, rip open a hole,
and then they let go, and then they just watch you.
And
they will watch you.
Yeah.
A bunch of Lieutenant Van Horsenbach, or Hensenbach, a bunch of his guys died from bites.
Oh, okay.
That's because they're good. Just like, little ones bit him, and they're like, oh, okay, whatever, a lizard bit me.
Yeah.
And then their, you know, pus starts coming out of their arms and their eyes and stuff like that.
Melt out of their head.
Yeah. So, yeah, they're Komodo dragons. So, yeah, you're a European settler, or wait, you're a Dutch settler.
I got one. Push the...
Okay, let me get the right one.
Yeah. You know what Meatloaf said, 2 out of 3 ain't bad. I guess, but it's not good if 2 out of 3 is what you missed.
Yeah, so they didn't get into a scientific collection until 1927. Started witnessing their behaviors of these animals in a scientific meeting in the Zoological Study of London in 1928.
Oh.
They were probably, here's the crazy thing about Komodo dragons, is that they were probably in circulation in the circus and pet trade before they were formally discovered.
Really?
Yes.
That's kind of wild.
Because people were going and catching baby giant monitor lizards.
Yeah.
Because there was other giant monitor lizards in selling them to the circus trade to have giant lizards like land crocodiles on display.
So people were going to these islands?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Or around or meeting trade and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And buying baby lizards.
I guess that makes sense. It's only in 1920s. It's not like, we were just about to start a world war. So yeah, we can get around the world just fine.
This was in between the world wars.
Was it?
1920s?
Yeah. I guess, yeah, I guess you're right, yeah.
Hitler didn't go into power until 26.
Yeah, World War II started in the 30s, right?
The later 30s.
Yeah.
The actual war, right, I think Hitler went into, started his political in, that mid to late 20s.
And then the Depression happened here, and then we happened to go to war, and
there
that
was a
saved
lot.
Us from the, it's was, all, like, convenient.
Well, no, not this show.
Oh, yeah.
So in 1926, W. Douglas Burton led an expedition to study the Komodo dragons on Komodo Island.
Okay.
Because these were still monsters of myth, even though they had a couple of them
right.
in captivity. They were not huge. But these inspired all kinds of legends around them. The team brought back 12 preserved specimens and 2 live ones, which later inspired the 1933 movie King Kong.
Oh, wow.
The whole theory was this island
inspired
with monsters was inspired by Komodo dragons.
That's kind of cool.
They were like, yeah, we go to this island and there's 20-foot lizards down there that eat people.
Yeah.
Hmm. Burden is credited with coining the common name, the Komodo dragon.
Who was?
Burnin, the guy that went down in 1926.
Gotcha. Okay, okay.
Because they were called land crocodiles before that, or land crocodile miners, which are a different thing. There was just a couple colloquial names that didn't really fit. And I could not find the natives' names for them beforehand. But yeah, he brought back three of his specimens that were still on that are still on display at the American Museum of Natural History.
That's
his taxidermied specimens.
That's pretty cool.
The Dutch government recognized the limited population of Komodo dragons in the wild area, and as a result, banned immediately the sports hunting and heavily restricted the number of dragons taken for scientific study.
Hmm.
So they were immediately like, these things are not, there's not a lot of them.
Yeah, so leave them alone.
So they said, the Dutch, the white people, you're not allowed to kill them, and scientific studies, you have to fill out a lot of paperwork to even go get one.
Hmm. Making it difficult.
I mean, no, but this is one of the first animals that any government, any Western government really even cared about.
Just shocking.
And it was just because they captivated.
They probably, well, okay, that's why.
They captivated. The Komodo dragons are very, very important for modern society, as in the captivating, the myth and the monsters that dragons are real.
Yeah.
In Europe, it was this whole massive thing. And all of a sudden, when an 8-foot dragon
shows up, yeah.
They're like, they're real? We killed all of our dragons, and they still live. And so it inspired a whole generation of like monster movies and this kind of stuff, where there are places still that have monsters,
in
a sense. So I think that's why the Dutch government took it very, very seriously, is that it was a real monster, in the fact that it was an unknown creature that was talked about, and then they went in the jungle, and then there was one standing there.
Right, and it's deadly.
But yeah, in the 1950s and 60s, researchers focused heavily on the Komodo dragon's feeding behaviors, reproduction, and body temperatures. During this time, the expedition was organized for long-term studies of Komodo dragon, carried by the Offenberg family. They spent 11 months on the island in 1969, which during the father, Walter, and his assistant, Parta, captured and tagged over 50 adult Komodo dragons. The research from the expedition greatly contributed to the understanding of Komodo dragons in captivity. Subsequently, researchers led by biologists such as Cordo Coffey provided more comprehensive understanding of the nature of these dragons. In 1927, the first Komodo dragon was on display, like what I said, in the London Zoo. The Komodo dragon was also exhibited in 1934 by the National Zoo in Washington, D.C., but unfortunately, it only lived for 2 years.
Hmm.
More attempts of the exhibit of Komodo dragons were made, but the creatures often had very short lifespans, averaging less than 5 years in national zoological parks. Walter Offenberg's studies, though, in his books, The Behavioral Ecological of Komodo Monitors, eventually allowed for more successful management and reproduction of them in captivity.
Hmm.
Well, so good. Until they went through and they literally sat and watched them for a year.
Yeah.
And they watched these 50 adults and just figured out body temperatures, feeding behaviors. So a lot of the ones, I think, died early in zoos because they were eating things and getting impacted bowels.
New foreign foods, I guess.
That, I mean, everything from toys to pieces of the enclosure. Oh, okay. I'm talking like that.
Things like that.
Because they eat chunks of bone in the wild and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But a steel ball or a chunk of, you know, fiberglass or something like that.
Doesn't
or
dissolve concrete. So easily. Yeah.
And Komodo dragons, if you watch them, they will eat anything. Monitor lizards are incredibly smart.
So they're like a
but they're also very, very curious.
Yeah.
Where they'll just, can I eat that?
It's like a 1-year-old.
And then one more cool thing before we wrap up. Maybe we can fit one more in. I don't know. We have like 30 of these things to get through.
We got no rush. It's a season finale.
It is a season finale. One more thing is parthenogenesis.
Okay.
Komodo dragons can clone themselves.
Ooh. So, is it cloning or is it that?
It's technically cloning.
Yeah,
parthenogenesis is a female reproducing without a male. All of her offspring are genetically identical to her.
Yes.
So it is a type of cloning in the basic sense.
I just learned about this someone was trying to teach me this about a plant or something. Just this past weekend, they were talking to me, this plant, like they're like, yeah, actually when it gets stressed out, it'll produce like a small little like stamen and it'll self-pollinate, you know, when it's stressed and it.
So it's very similar. Flora is the Komodo dragon that they actually studied this with in 2006.
Mm.
This is a very new discovery.
Okay.
Where she laid eggs that hatched and she'd never been with a male.
Yeah, that's odd.
And it's to this point where They think it's because they're an island species. And other minor lizards kind of do this. What?
That's what that Komodo dragon says. She's never been with another male.
But they think it's due to being an island species that has such a heavy fluctuation to prey availability.
Uh-huh.
That their populations are probably subsequent to highs and lows.
Mm-hmm. Ebbs and flows.
Yeah, so during the lows, if she can't find a male, she can reproduce and they can do it one time.
Yeah, it's not a forever thing.
But it may have saved their species many a times when they'd eaten all the large prey from their islands.
It just gives them a little extra chance, yeah.
Yeah, and they're going to go into stasis for a while.
Because I imagine if you do that over and over and over, like...
It's just cloning. So what happens is, there's not actually, at least immediately, a lot of... Like, there's no genetic problems.
Yeah, yeah.
If the mom doesn't have genetic problems, there's no genetic problems. It's diseases.
Oh, okay.
That are really a problem with cloned animals.
I like the story of the House of Asher, I think it's called. I'll have to look it up.
So when you have closely related individuals, especially parthenogenic individuals, because they're technically, genetically... the same individual, they can become susceptible to disease outbreaks very quickly.
Okay.
Because there's no genetic variation. So like in humans, some of us get sick often, others never get sick. Types of flu, even within our populations, like there are specific diseases that affect races.
Right, like sickle cell anemia.
Well, that's not that's a genetic disorder.
Okay.
And it's to prevent malaria.
Yeah.
No.
I guess it's not. You're right, yeah.
It's a genetic disorder, not a transmittable disease.
I was thinking more like you're sick, like the flu. It's not like that.
It's not like that.
Yeah.
But it is, you know, almost exclusively African-Americans or African-American lineage. Right, it's a genetic,
regional, yes.
But there are diseases that affect, I got them.
Yeah, the
Vietnamese lungworms.
Lungworm, yeah.
And they're not because they're from Vietnamese. They're from, mostly Vietnamese people get them. They are a little more susceptible to them.
Maybe you do have a little bit of Vietnamese in you and you just didn't know.
Well, Grandpa did serve in Vietnam.
I don't think it works that way. Your grandpa, yeah. He did. Yeah. I think he, never mind. Never mind.
My aunt was born without hips. My mom had Hodgkin's lymphoma. Yeah. Does that make me Vietnamese?
I think so. I think they both cancel out and equals Vietnam.
If anybody doesn't know, that they were both caused by Agent Orange exposure to my grandpa.
Yeah, probably.
No, I mean, they were. I mean, 100%. Because those were both the birth defects, the top two birth defects listed.
Really? Wow.
For their kids.
Ain't that nuts? It can translate, though, just from, like, I guess his testicles, pretty much.
Oh, yeah, it's damaged DNA.
Right, yeah. But like you're constantly reproducing that stuff, it
doesn't matter.
Yeah, it's permanently damaged. That's crazy.
The code source is damaged.
Yes, that's nuts to me. So like
that's things like what CRISPR can fix.
Wow, the good side of the sword.
No, it's anything. It's any weapon, any science
tool.
So like that's the kind of thing that CRISPR could fix.
Yeah,
because you could just rewrite it, and it would take time.
Right.
So right now CRISPR is not the cure for cancer right now.
No.
Because cancer's too fast.
Yeah, they're just using it to create these hybrid abomination animals and release them upon the world and pretend there's like other it's something things. Else.
CRISPR doesn't really do that.
Oh.
But we've talked about that.
Well, I mean, I was talking about the dire wolf. Or the quote.
That's not CRISPR.
Oh, it's not?
No.
Oh, okay. Ain't close enough.
No, they're using CRISPR for they're saving species other side of the thing.
Okay.
Perpetuating so they can change DNA of the red wolves because they only have a couple individuals can make them quote unquote other individuals
or
mix them up
so they're genetically viable diverse
they're different
yeah
so it gets away from cloning so Komodo dragons, you got one right.
Out of three.
This is, I guess, part one of the season finale, the once was's.
Yeah, the once was's. This will be fun. I'm looking forward to the rest of them.
Are you liking it so far?
Yeah, it is. It's a big extended Freaky Fauna Friday, kind of, in a way.
Oh, but they're all cryptids. They all were cryptids.
Correct. Yeah.
Everybody on this list was a cryptid, and some are really recent.
Yeah.
And we haven't even got to some of the really recent ones. Some of them have only been seen twice alive.
Wow.
All right. Well, I've been the great and powerful Mr. E.
And I've been J-Clone779.
This has been part one of the season 7 finale.
Bye.
Hey, guys. Thank you for listening to Cryptids of the Corn podcast. Remember, the best way to support the show is share it with a friend. But if you are craving more of the J clones
and more from Mr. E,
there's always extra content on Patreon
and our paid member space on cryptidsofthecorn.com.
We'll catch you next time with more exciting, fun, and informative information.
Bye.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.